See, no one's paying any attention. Now, if I said we were pulling tickets for the $1 million lottery, everyone would have stood up and taken notice.
Right.
Ruth Holmberg needs no introduction. I've really agreed to do this so I could get a reserved seat. This really is a record crowd for an event at the History Museum. Many of you are personal friends of Ruth. Some of you are professional colleagues. All of you, I'm sure, as I have been, are intrigued by the story that began 115 years ago when Adolph Ox came to Chattanooga to enter the newspaper publishing business. This picture over here and the picture upstairs in the permanent exhibit is a picture of him when he was probably 20 or 21 years old. And I think it was well chosen because we often forget how young he was when he was here. The mustache he grew because his editor, a well-known Union officer and editor, Colonel John McGowan, was over 25 years older than he was, and his children were older than Adolph Ox. So in order to present a more older, dignified appearance, he grew a mustache. The story that Ruth is going to reminisce with you a little bit from a personal point of view today is a fascinating tale of two cities and two newspapers and the family which unites them. Dr. Livingood's books tell the story of Adolph Ox coming to Chattanooga from Knoxville in 1877 at age 19 to enter the newspaper business, of the quick demise of the first venture, which was a newspaper with a jointly being published and edited by the man who was the publisher and editor, I think, of the Chattanooga Rebel during the Civil War, of the quick demise of that first venture, of his enterprise in researching and publishing the first city directory, which tells us that at this time the estimated population was 11,448 persons, and of his purchase a few months later in 1878 of a half interest in another struggling newspaper, his enthusiastic involvement in all phases of the young city's life, and his departure in 1896 to begin publication of the New York Times. The part of the story that is so intriguing and so meaningful to Chattanoogans is the interest and support of the family that has continued for three generations. Adolph Ox's personal involvement with this city did not cease when he moved to New York. He was involved in many important things that happened up in the 20th century into the 30s. I think the one that you might know most about is his involvement with the purchase of the property of Point Park and the land under Point Park where the Point Hotel was, and of organizing a group of citizens to purchase hundreds of acres on the side of Lookout Mountain. All of this was put into the park system in the 30s. Ruth's parents, Iphigenie and Arthur Sulzberger, continued this interest and involvement, as have their children, Marion, Ruth, Punch, and Judy. It is this, and this is what Ruth will tell you a little more about. Just one more thing. Ruth also came to Chattanooga as a young person. She was a little older than 19, but not too much. She had graduated from Smith College, had worked during the war in the Red Cross, and had married, but she was a young woman who became quickly and deeply involved in all aspects of the city's life. I've known Ruth since the mid-50s. I think of her first as a friend, but also I secretly kind of think of her as first woman, because the first time I thought of her that way, she was the first woman president of the Chattanooga Symphony Association, and since that time she has been the first woman on more boards than I could possibly imagine, and culminating in her job as president of the Chamber of Commerce, a job, incidentally, that Adolph Ox would have approved of, because he and the Times were very strong boosters of the business growth and diversification in Chattanooga during those early years. Ruth is known for, like her grandfather, for her intelligence, her integrity, her sense of humor, and her generous commitment of spirit and substance. That generosity here at the History Museum is on view in the permanent collection, which appropriately is called the New South, since Mr. Ox was an advocate of a diversified economy in the New South. When I called, we were calling around for personal mementos of members of prominent families in Chattanooga, I called Ruth to see if she had some kind of personal object from her grandfather. And she said, well, the only thing I have, I'm not sure I'd want to give up. It's a leather-bound copy of the first city directory, which, when you look at it, bears a striking resemblance to the present one, except it's smaller. And a few weeks later, she told us that she wanted us to have it. So it's up there, along with the picture of the young Adolph Ox. Without any more, I want to turn this over to Ruth to share with us some of the fascinating stories she has.
Thank you. Aside from her very generous comments about me, Lynn has told you my whole story, so I'll just take questions. I really am amazed and embarrassed and horrified to see so many of you here on such a pretty day. Those of you who normally take a nap on Sunday, please feel free. I had no idea there would be so many. I had been told this would be a fireside chat, and here's the fireside, and here, incidentally, is another chair. So someone should make themselves comfortable. I am amazed at this audience. There are people in this audience that know far more about my subject than I do. Jim Livingood, for instance, could tell you the history of the Chattanooga Times inside out and backwards. Hello, Jim. Norman Bradley was our editor for many years, and Bob Suttoth back here ran the circulation department in amazing fashion for eons. I saw Raymond Cook, I don't see him now, somewheres. There he is, who kept our composing room going. And then even here in the audience today is Paul Neely, the deputy publisher today, who will lead this paper into the future in excellent fashion. So you're all excused now. The history of the Chattanooga Times really is mostly a history of a remarkable man and the vision that he had for journalism that has inspired the continuing generations of his family, along with many other people, of course. But I will have to start this story by telling you something about Adolph Ox. As Lynn said, he came to town here in 1877, when he was 19 years old. Prior to that, he was born in Cincinnati, and the family then moved rather quickly to Knoxville. He came from interesting parents. His mother was born in Bavaria, and when she was a young girl, she got her a close classmate of hers was executed in the uprising and the revolution, and she and another friend of hers protested that they dipped their handkerchiefs in the executed woman's blood and were brandishing it and causing a demonstration. And so her parents were told that she was in some jeopardy and they should get her out of the country. And so that's how she happened to come to America. She was sent to Natchez, Mississippi, where she lived with an uncle. And it was there in Natchez that two things happened. One, she became very strongly a Southern sympathizer, and she rebelled against injustice in Bavaria, but slavery in America didn't seem to trouble her. And she also met Julius Ox, who also lived in Natchez, and was had a variety of careers. He was a salesman and a shopkeeper. Anyway, they were married. And right after the war broke out, the Civil War, he enlisted in the army and was very quickly made a colonel. And one of his responsibilities was to keep rebel troops or rebel sympathizers from moving supplies across the lines. And at the same time that he was doing that, his wife was smuggling medical supplies in a baby buggy to the rebel troops. But somehow this marriage survived, and when Julius Ox died, he was buried with some fanfare by the army under a Union flag. And when his wife died some years later, she had been a founding member of the Daughters of the Confederacy, and at her request, she was buried under a Confederate flag, and they are buried side by side at the Mizpah Congregation Cemetery out on 3rd Street. But anyway, this is the atmosphere of his family. They had 7 children, and 6 of them survived, and Adolf was the oldest surviving child. When Julius Ox was a charming man, he spoke 7 languages, and he played a musical instrument, and even wrote some light opera, and he taught French for a year, and he did all these things, but he was not particularly good at making a living, and his family had a great struggle. When Adolf was 9 years old, he started delivering newspapers, and his younger brothers, as the years went by, the younger brothers would also help, and Julius had to accept, of course, these few pennies that they were bringing in to help the family income, and felt badly, and apparently he went and down with them every morning, 3 a.m. in the morning, and helped them fold and sort their papers before they started on the routes. Adolf was a pretty raggedy-looking kid, apparently, in thin breeches, and one of the members of his route felt sorry for him and gave him a pair of heavy trousers to keep him warm. And he never forgot that kindness. And after he had bought the Chattanooga Times and it was prospering, he sent that family some shares of stock as a thank you for those warm breeches, which they had in their family been for many, many years. When he was 14 years old, he dropped out of school and went to the Chronicle office in Knoxville, the Chronicle newspaper, and asked for a job. And the editor kind of asked him what he could do, and he said, well, he could start by cleaning up the place, which was pretty much a mess, which is the way newspaper offices are. And so he polished up everything in sight and endeared himself to the owner, who gave him a job. Well, he told my mother years later that his newspaper career really started because he was afraid of ghosts. He had to walk past a cemetery at night to go home, and he didn't get home, he didn't get off work until midnight. And that was when the spooks rise at midnight, and he didn't want to walk by the cemetery by himself. Well, the composing room foreman lived just a few blocks beyond his house, and he worked till 2 a.m. So Adolf hung around the newspaper until 2 so that he could walk home with this man. And he learned a good deal, of course, about the newspaper business in that way. When he was 17, he decided he had nothing more to learn where he was, and he took off as a tramp printer and ended up in Louisville, Kentucky, at the Courier Journal. And he worked there and finally was made composing room foreman. But they missed him at home, and he was very homesick, and he finally returned to Knoxville. He then took a job at the Knoxville Tribune, and the business manager there, Paul Frank, had big ideas about publishing a newspaper of his own. And he prevailed on Adolf to go with him to Chattanooga, and also with an editor that Lynn referred to, Colonel McGowan. So the three of them went off to Chattanooga to start a newspaper. Well, Chattanooga needed a new newspaper like a hole in its head. It had about 7 or 9, depending on what day it was, and they were coming and going. But they came down here, and that was in 1877, when he was 19 years old. And they launched the Chattanooga Dispatch, which lived up to his name and was quickly dispatched. It simply didn't last any time at all. And Adolf took on the responsibility of assuming the debts and trying to get rid of them. He was left with the press, which was helpful to him because, as Lynn told you, he began assembling the first Chattanooga directory. In the process of publishing this city directory, of course, he got to know the business community and got to know the community itself very well. So at that time, a year after that, in 1878, the Chattanooga Times, that was then 9 years old, was struggling. It was in terrible debt. It had 250 readers, and Adolf Ox thought he could make a go of it, but he had no money. So he went to a banker in town, and there's some, we're not quite sure whether that banker was a Mr. James or a Mr. Montague, but one or the other. He went to them and asked for a loan of $300. And the banker asked him what collateral he had, and he said he had none. And the banker asked who could sign his note, and he said, well, I don't believe there's anyone in town that knows me any better than you do. And the banker the banker signed his own note and loaned him $350. Well, he paid $250 for a half interest in the Times, and the arrangement was that the second half would be determined, the worth of the second half would be determined by an impartial arbiter after a period of time. Adolf had to have his father Julius come from Knoxville to sign the papers because he had not yet reached his 21st birthday. The plant was located right across from Profits downtown, on where that parking lot is at the moment, 8th and Cherry. And it didn't appear to be much of a bargain. It was a tiny little building with dilapidated equipment. Adolf persuaded the much older Colonel McGowan to come to work as editor for $1.50 a day. And there were four unemployed printers that were available, and one reporter that signed on. And between all of them, I don't think they had more than about $35. Well, they had $37.50, I believe. And of that money, he spent $25 to maintain his association with the Associated Press, which of course brought the news from everywhere that he needed to put in his paper. So his father stayed on with him to keep the books. And they had a struggle, but every night Adolf sent $2 to Knoxville to his mother to help maintain the other children. It wasn't long after that that a yellow fever epidemic broke out, and people fled out of town, and the circulation, of course, plummeted, and the paper went down to one page, but it did survive. And it was a rocky road for several years. He wrote a quote, which I think is interesting, tells you how things were going, from a letter that he wrote in 1881. He said, "Mr. Souter paid me $108, a godsend, borrowed from Ewing Brothers $125 for a few days, asked Mr. Z.C. Patton for the loan of $200 for a few days, but he couldn't do it. He was going to the bank to try and get some for himself." Well, it was in those very early days that his declaration of policy about the kind of newspapers the newspaper he wanted to publish were determined. He wrote, "We shall give the people a chance to support that which they've been asking for, a newspaper primarily devoted to the material, educational, and moral growth of our progressive city and its surrounding territory." And this was apparently what people wanted, because the paper prospered. And in 4 years, the purchase price for the second half was determined to be $550. No, excuse me, $5,500. The paper was making a very good profit, and the Ox family had all moved to Chattanooga. And Adolf had his two brothers working at the paper, and his father was also there. Subsequently, he built the Dome building, which of course was then the Times building, the one that was so beautifully restored by Gordon Street. And in the late 1880s, they moved into that building, which was the most progressive newspaper plant in the southeast. Many years ago, when one of my children was about 9 years old, we were driving down the street, and he pointed to this dome and he said, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, that is a building that your great-grandfather built to publish the Chattanooga Times. And when he built it, it was the biggest building in town." And Michael looked at it and he said, "Well, then how come it's littling?" It hasn't littled a whole lot, though. It's a beautiful building. In the 1880s, the land craze hit this part of the country, as it did a good many other places, and Adolf started buying up land, and pretty soon it became clear that that was not a marvelous thing to have done, and he was over his head in debt with worthless land. At one point, though, he did offer a lot to every new subscriber of the Times, out of a parcel of land known as Timesville, which you may remember up on the back of Signal Mountain. And I like to think you still get a lot when you buy the Times. But because he was deeply in debt, he was looking for other investments. And that's what took him to New York, in search of financing, and also in search of perhaps another property. Well, in 1896, the New York Times was a failing newspaper, very much the same way that the Chattanooga Times had been. Of course, this is a much larger city, so it had more than 250 subscribers, but it had about 9,000, which is not very much. and it was heavily in debt. There were 15 newspapers in New York at that time, and these are the days of the big newspaper barons. There was the Pulitzer's World and William Randolph Hearst's Journal, and these were huge newspapers, three and four and 500,000 circulation. James Gordon Bennett's Herald and the Tribune and the Sun, and a lot of these names I'm sure are familiar to you. He felt that, Adolf felt that he could change the fortunes of the New York Times very much as he had the Chattanooga Times. And what he had done here was, as I said, determined that people really wanted the news, and given the news, they could form their opinion about matters, and they needed to be informed. And, the Times in New York was following the same pattern that the other newspapers of that day followed, and they were filling their paper with syndicated stories and with rumors and gossip, and they weren't as bad as the supermarket tabloids, but they weren't a whole lot better. He visited with the people who were running the Times, and they offered him the job as manager with a salary of $50,000 a year, which was an immense salary in those days, but he wasn't interested in that kind of a deal, and said he wasn't looking for employment. He knew that they had extreme debts and that the circulation was as low as it was. And he proposed a refinancing that would give him an interest in the company and an option to acquire majority interest as soon as the paper turned a profit. And it turned out that that happened in less than 4 years. And he had his control then of 5,000 shares of the New York Times stock. The newspapers of Hertz and Pulitzer and the rest of them, excuse me, are no longer published in New York. All those giants have gone by the wayside for one unhappy reason or another. The last one to depart the scene, or one of the very last, was the Herald Tribune. The result of the merger between the Herald and the Tribune. And I think what spelled the death of that paper during World War II, when newsprint became in very short supply, and of course the war was going on, newspapers had to make a determination about whether, how to allot their space, whether they would fill their papers with news, or whether they would curtail the news and continue with their advertising and their profits. And the Herald Tribune chose the route to curtail the news, and the New York Times limited their advertising and filled their paper with news, and that really turned the table there. That, of course, being in direct response to Adolf Ochs's theory about what should constitute good journalism. The paper, this paper has been in the same family here since 1878, and the relationship between the Chattanooga Times and the New York Times has always been mysterious to people in Chattanooga, and I guess to people in the rest of the country as well, who don't know that the Chattanooga Times is the mother of this rather larger child. Adolf Ochs married Effie Wise, who was the daughter of Rabbi Isaac M. Wise in Cincinnati. He was the father of Reform Judaism and the founder of the Hebrew Union College. They married and they had just one child, my mother, whose name was Iphigenia, mysterious name. Her mother's name Effie's real name was Iphigenia. Rabbi Wise was a reader of Greek mythology, and he was busily engaged in that pursuit when they came and told him he had another daughter, and so he said, name her Iphigenia. She shortened it to Effie, but my mother went through her very long and wonderful life with the name of Iphigenia. She married Arthur Sulzberger, and he became publisher at my grandfather's death. And since then, his son, my brother Punch, succeeded him as publisher. And just last Thursday, his son succeeded him. So we have a new publisher at the New York Times. My grandfather, to continue his story just briefly, was always devoted to Chattanooga. When anyone asked him what was home, even all the years that he lived in New York, he said his home was in Chattanooga. And he was very seriously affected by Hitler's rise in power, and he suffered quite a serious nervous breakdown and illness. And then he got better. This was in 1935, and decided he wanted to pay another visit to Chattanooga. And he wanted to bring one of his grandchildren with him. So he took my oldest sister, Marion, and they came down to Chattanooga. And he had a wonderful visit. Everybody stopped and spoke with him, and he had a grand time. And he was ordering lunch up at the old coffee shop where the brass register is now, and simply went to sleep and died in the hospital right across the street, which was Ed Newell's hospital. I made a terrible boner one time when I first moved to town, and I was at a dinner party and sitting next to Ed Newell, and I said, you and I have a lot in common. And he said, what's that? I said, my grandfather died in your hospital. Well, he didn't think that was wonderful. the family has been very much involved, all of us. We're a close family, I'm happy to say. Let me illustrate that with a silly story. My brother was in Hawaii at the time of the Bingham family breakup in Louisville. I imagine you've all read about that. That was quite a to-do. And someone came into a meeting where my brother was and said that Sally Bingham was selling her stock. And my brother got up and started out of the room, and someone said to him, where are you going? And he said, I'm going to send flowers to my sisters. My mother and father had four children, and the four of us have 13 children between us, and there are 24 grandchildren. And as Paul pointed out in his column yesterday that I imagine you saw, all 57 were here in Chattanooga for a family reunion last October, and it was wonderful. We had a great time. In addition to my nephew, Arthur, that's the new publisher of the Times, my oldest son, Stephen, is a vice president of the company in charge of forest products. And my second son, Michael, is a senior vice president and general manager of the women's division of magazine group. And my younger sister, Judy, has a son who's in charge of circulation sales development. And my older sister has a daughter who's charged with continuing the New York Times history in archives. The Times has grown considerably since the days that Adolph bought it as a struggling paper in New York. The company now owns 24 newspapers daily or weekly throughout the Southeast, and some in California and in Winning, Maine. They have 17 magazines, including Family Circle, McCall's, and Child Magazine, Golf Digest, Tennis, Cruising World, and other sporting magazines. 5 television stations, QXR, WQXR is a AM/FM radio station in New York, and also a news service and syndicate service. They have interest in Canadian newsprint mills and in a super calendar mill in Maine, which is the mill that makes that glossy paper that the magazine is printed on. They also have a half interest in the International Herald Tribune in Paris. The other half is owned by the Washington Post Company. I lost my train. I really would welcome your questions. I know this has been awfully rambling, but I was expecting 12 people around a fireplace. So if you do have questions, I would welcome them. No, his home was on 5th and Cedar, and the freeway is there now. But it's the house some of you may remember that Selman Franklin lived in. It was a beautiful brick house with white columns that he built. He built this for his family, and they all lived there. It was like Dallas. He wasn't mayor. That was his brother. No. He had a brother by the name of George Washington Ox, who after the war decided, well, at the time of the war, decided that the name Ox was too Germanic, and so he changed his name to Ox-Oaks. So he was Ox Oaks all his life, and then when he died, his sons dropped the Ox, and their name is Oaks now. John Oakes was editor of the New York Times for a number of years, but it was he who was mayor of Chattanooga. And then Milton Ox, his other brother, lived on Missionary Ridge for many, many years. Well, all his life. Yeah. Well, I was in the Red Cross during the war in Europe, and I met a soldier who came from Chattanooga, not from Chattanooga, from Knoxville. And he was with the TVA, and we were married, and we moved to Knoxville. But we didn't stay there long, and that's the way to do Knoxville, is not to stay long. And he was offered the opportunity to go to work for the Chattanooga Times. And then he was publisher of the Chattanooga Times for a few years, Ben Golden. And then we were divorced. The power and the glory. Well, I thought it was mostly fiction, but I've always, well, that's not quite fair. I think it's very difficult for, he was reporting conversations in a room with two people, you know. It was full of all these conversations of who said what to whom. And my mother often said that our family wouldn't make a wonderful story because there wasn't enough juicy gossip. But I don't think Gay's book was really very gospel. Do you think that's fair, Jim?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I didn't mean to, because Chattanooga is where I live. I'm happy to report. And, he loved it very much, and so do I. Adolph Fox, yeah, there's a lot I left out. You see, I didn't make notes. he built the Ox Temple as a memorial to his parents, and which is, it's a very beautiful building. If any of you have not been in it, I encourage you to go. It's really lovely. And then, as Lynn said, he was very interested in the park and helping to secure land for to preserve Point Park and to preserve, to create that drive, the Ox Highway up to Lookout Mountain. That particular edition is published in Gwinnett County, just north of Atlanta. The New York Times National Edition is going very well and is published in 6 or 7 locations around the country. It's wonderful to have it, isn't it? Yes. There's a plaque in Chattanooga, in Knoxville. I can't explain that. Possible, yeah. Yes, no, I don't know anything about that. Sorry. Well, I thank you all so much.